Welcome to The Deep Dive. Today, we're getting into something really important for anyone dealing with chronic lung disease, the brand new JSEPOC 2025 guidelines, specifically how we treat stable COPD pharmacologically. And look, if you're in respiratory medicine or even just tracking chronic diseases, you know COPD isn't just one thing, it's complex. Treatment often felt, well, a bit scattershot maybe. But these guidelines signal a major change. The big takeaway. We're really diving headfirst into precision medicine, moving past those simple stages into treatment plans that are, you know, highly tailored to the individual patient, based on their specific characteristics, their risks, even their biomarkers.
That shift is precisely why these guidelines are generating so much buzz.
Yeah.
They offer a really clear, structured approach. It's not just a drug list.
Yeah.
JSEPOC 2025 gives us this five-stage framework for managing the patient.
Okay, five stages. Lay them out for us.
Sure. It starts with a diagnosis.
Yeah.
Then moves to risk stratification. After that, detailed characterization of the patient. Then obviously initiation and continuation of treatment. And finally, follow-up.
And the goal throughout all five.
The goal is consistent. Relieve those symptoms, definitely improve quality of life, prevent exacerbations, those flare-ups are critical, and ultimately help people live longer.
It's interesting, JSEPOC was kind of ahead of the game on this, weren't they? They pushed for this phenotype approach early on.
They really were. The first major COPD guideline to really champion classifying patients beyond just, say, their FEV1 score.
And it seems like clinicians bought in. The numbers suggest it's being used.
Yeah, the data shows pretty significant uptake. You mentioned it, phenotype classification in medical records jumped from, what, around 46% in 2015 up to over 63% by 2021. So yes, there's a clear move towards this personalized view in practice.
Okay, so let's walk through that five-stage roadmap. Stage one, diagnosis. How do we nail that down according to these new guidelines?
Right, diagnosis. It hinges on three key pillars. First, you need that history of exposure. We're talking risk factors.
Like smoking.
Primarily smoking, yes. The guideline mentions 10 pack years as a benchmark. Or chronic exposure to other inhaled toxins like biomass fuels or occupational dust.
Okay, exposure history. What's next?
Second, the patient needs to have respiratory symptoms. You know, chronic cough, bringing up sputum, shortness of breath.
And the third pillar, the confirmation.
That's spirometry. It's essential. You need to show post-bronchodilator airflow obstruction. Specifically, that FEV1-FVC ratio has to be less than 0.7.
That 0.7 number, it's pretty fixed, isn't it? But we know COPD often gets missed, right? Especially early on. What about tools for catching it sooner, maybe in primary care?
That's a huge issue, the underdiagnosis. So yes, for opportunistic case finding, screening people who might be at risk but haven't been diagnosed, the guidelines suggest using simple tools.
Right, questionnaires.
Exactly. Things like the COPD PAS or the PMA questionnaire. And also portable spirometers are mentioned. Devices like the COPD6 or PICO6, which measure FEV1-FEV6.
So those are helpful for screening.
They are very useful, yes. For identifying who needs the full formal spirometry test. But, and this is crucial, they don't replace it for the actual diagnosis. They're screening tools, not diagnostic tools.
Got it. Screening flags, potential cases, full spirometry confirms. So once we have that confirmed diagnosis, we hit stage two. Risk stratification, low risk versus high risk. How's that determined?
Okay, risk stratification is critical because it really dictates the intensity of treatment. It's based on assessing three things together.
What are they?
One, the degree of airflow obstructions, the post-bronchodilator FEV1% predicted. Two, the degree of dyspnea or breathlessness, usually measured with the MMRC scale. And three, the patient's exacerbation history over the last year.
So that history is really key.
Absolutely crucial. If a patient has severe symptoms like a high MMRC score, or if they've had frequent or severe exacerbations, they immediately fall into the high risk category.
And high risk means more intensive treatment needed right away.
Exactly. It signals that we need to be more aggressive with interventions from the start.
Before we jump into those specific drug therapies, especially for the high-risk folks, there are some basic things that apply to everyone with COPD, right?
Oh, absolutely. These general measures are foundational, non-negotiable really for every single patient.
Like smoking cessation.
Top of the list.
Yeah.
Always. But also proper nutrition, encouraging regular physical activity as much as they can tolerate, and importantly, a really robust vaccination strategy.
You mentioned vaccines. It feels like there's more emphasis there now.
Definitely. It's not just the annual flu shot anymore. JSEPOC 2025 specifically calls out the pneumococcal 20-valent conjugate vaccine, COVID-19 vaccines, RSV, Tdap, and even the herpes zoster vaccine. It's comprehensive.
So immunization is really positioned as a core part of therapy now.
You could say that, yes. Protecting against preventable infections is vital.
Okay, foundations laid. Let's move to the core pharmacology, stage four. Initiation and continuation of treatment. What's the absolute cornerstone therapy for stable COPD?
The cornerstone is inhaled medication, specifically long-acting bronchodilators or LABDs.
LABs. That covers two main classes.
Right. It's an umbrella term for the long-acting beta agonists, the LABAs, and the long-acting muscarinic antagonists, the LAMAs. These are generally the first-line drugs to open the airways and ease symptoms.
Okay, LABAs and LAMAs. Now, if a patient only needs one long-acting agent monotherapy, do the guidelines prefer one over the other?
They do offer a suggestion here based on PICO question one in the guideline document. If monotherapy is the choice, they suggest using a LAMA over a LABA.
Why the preference for LAMA, like tiotropium or meclidinium?
It comes down to exacerbation prevention. While both LABAs and LAMAs are effective bronchodilators, the evidence suggests LAMAs might have an edge in reducing the frequency of future exacerbations, and preventing those is a major goal.
Right, keeping people stable and out of the hospital. But many patients need more than just one drug, especially if symptoms continue. For a low-risk patient still symptomatic on monotherapy, what's the next step?
If a low-risk patient is still having persistent symptoms despite being on a LAMA or a LABA alone, the next step is clear and strongly recommended. Dual bronchodilation.
So combining a LABA and a LAMA.
Exactly. LABA-LAMA combination inhalers. This isn't just a small step up. The evidence shows significant added benefits. Better symptom control, definitely. Improved exercise capacity, which is huge for quality of life. And less need for the rescue inhaler.
Speaking of rescue inhalers, the short-acting ones, SABA or SAMA, they still have a role.
Oh, absolutely. They remain the go-to treatment for immediate on-demand relief of symptoms. Everyone needs access to a rescue inhaler, regardless of their underlying long-acting therapy or severity.
Okay, now let's get into the really complex part. Stage three, characterization, especially for those high-risk patients. This is where the phenotype approach really takes center stage. Three phenotypes for high-risk individuals.
Yes, this is where it gets truly personalized. For high-risk patients, we classify them into one of three treatment pathways based on their phenotype: non-exacerbator, eosinophilic exacerbator, or non-eosinophilic exacerbator.
Okay, first step seems to be figuring out if they are an exacerbator. How is that defined?
An exacerbator isn't just someone who has occasional bad days. The definition is quite specific. It's someone who, in the previous year, had two or more moderate exacerbations.
Moderate meaning they needed steroids or antibiotics.
Correct. Systemic corticosteroids or antibiotics. Or, alternatively, they had at least one severe exacerbation, meaning one that required hospitalization.
Okay, so if they meet that exacerbator definition, then we need to figure out which kind of exacerbator they are.
Precisely. And that hinges on their inflammatory profile, specifically looking for type 2 inflammation.
And the key marker for that T2 inflammation in routine practice is?
It's the peripheral blood eosinophil count. It's readily available from a standard blood test.
So how does the eosinophil count separate the phenotypes? What's the magic number?
The critical threshold identified in EUSIPAC 2025 is 300 cells per cubic millimeter. If a high-risk exacerbator has a blood eosinophil count above 300 cells a man, they're classified as an eosinophilic exacerbator.
Greater than 300. That number seems incredibly important, then. It dictates the treatment path.
It absolutely does. If you're over 300 eosinophils, it strongly suggests that type 2 inflammation is driving the exacerbations, and that points us towards treatments that target that inflammation.
Which means?
It means using inhaled corticosteroids, or ICS, combined with the long-acting bronchodilators.
So, LABA-LAMA plus ICS, triple therapy.
Often, yes. Particularly for those eosinophilic exacerbators who are highly symptomatic, say, MMRC of 2 or more, or their FEV1 is below 50%, the recommendation is to initiate triple therapy, ABLMAICs, directly. The eosinophil count predicts they're likely to benefit from the ICS component.
And this is a big deal. The guidelines even look beyond inhaled therapy for some of these patients now, right? Incorporating biologics.
Yes, that's a major development, reflecting PO question 5. For a specific subset of patients, those with that clear T2 inflammation profile, often with mucus hypersecretion, who continue to exacerbate despite being on optimal inhaled therapy, usually triple therapy.
So the toughest case.
Exactly. For them, the guidelines now recommend considering dupilumab.
That's a biologic agent. How does it work?
It blocks the receptors for interleukin-4 and interleukin-13. Which are key drivers of T2 inflammation. Studies like the Boreas trial showed it reduced exacerbations by about 31% in this specific group. It's really pushing COPD treatment into the realm of targeted biologic therapies, similar to severe asthma.
Okay, that covers the eosinophilic side, the 300 group. Now, what about the other high-risk exacerbators, the ones below 300 eosinophils and the non-eosinophilic exacerbators?
Right. This group is thought to have predominantly T1 or T3 inflammation, where ICS efficacy is generally lower or even negligible.
So triple therapy isn't the go-to for them?
No. For these non-eosinophilic exacerbators, the initial suggestion, based on PISUD 6 and 7, is to start with dual bronchodilation.
Loblama.
Just the bronchodilators, no ICS?
Correct. In fact, the guidelines specifically advise against using triple therapy in patients with very low eosinophil counts, specifically less than 100 cell vim.
Because the evidence for benefit from ICS in that low eosinophil group is lacking. And importantly, adding ICS carries an increased risk of side effects, most notably pneumonia. So it's about maximizing benefit and minimizing harm. Stick with loblama if eosinophils are low.
This really highlights the complexity, especially for these high-risk patients who don't fit that clear eosinophilic profile. And that brings us to another key concept in GESIPOC 2025, treatable traits. This sounds like the ultimate step in personalization.
It really is. Treatable traits are specific characteristics. They could be clinical, physiological, like lung function measures, or biological, like biomarkers that we can identify in an individual patient and then target with a specific therapy, often layered on top of their foundational bronchodilator treatment.
So it's about finding specific problems we can address with specific add-on treatments.
Exactly. It allows us to fine-tune the management for those complex high-risk patients beyond just the broad phenotype.
Let's run through a few examples. What about patients with chronic bronchitis, that persistent cough and sputum who are still exacerbating?
Okay, so chronic bronchitis is a key treatable trait. If a patient has that profile and continues to exacerbate despite good inhaled therapy, like loblama, or even triple therapy if appropriate, the guidelines suggest considering adding a high-dose mucolytic.
Like carbacistine.
Carbacistine or high-dose N-acetylcysteine, yes. The idea is to target the mucus production and clearance problem directly. That's PICO9.
What if that patient with chronic bronchitis also has very severe airflow obstruction?
If you have that combination, an exacerbator with chronic bronchitis and severe airflow limitation, like FEV1 50%, then another treatable trait strategy comes into play. Roflumilast.
That's an oral medication.
Yes, it's an oral anti-inflammatory, a PDE4 inhibitor. It's suggested as a second-line add-on therapy specifically for this subgroup, PICO10. It tackles inflammation differently than inhaled steroids.
Okay, another trait mentioned is chronic bronchial infection, or CBI. When does that become a target?
This is for the patients having very frequent exacerbations, defined here as 3 or more moderate or severe ones in the past year, despite optimized inhaled treatment. If CBI is suspected, long-term macrolide therapy might be considered.
Like azithromycin?
Yes, typically azithromycin, often given 3 days a week. It has both anti-inflammatory and some antibacterial effects. But this needs real caution.
Why the caution?
Because the risks. Potential hearing issues, QTC prolongation on the ECG, and a major concern is promoting antibiotic resistance. So the guideline stresses this should really be restricted to specialized centers with very careful patient selection and monitoring PCONT11.
Understood. Before we leave treatable traits, there's one condition the guidelines say we must investigate in all COPD patients: alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency, AATD. Why the universal screening?
AATD is a genetic condition that can lead to early onset and severe emphysema. While it's relatively rare overall, finding it is critical. It has implications for the patient's prognosis, for potential family screening, and because there's a specific therapy.
Which is?
For patients who have emphysema confirmed to be due to severe AATD, augmentation therapy with purified human AAT is suggested, PICU8.
Does it help symptoms?
That's the caveat. The evidence shows it can slow down the loss of lung tissue, measured by CT density scans, which is important for disease modification, but it hasn't consistently shown improvements in symptoms or reduction in exacerbations. So it's more about preserving lung structure over the long term.
Okay, wow. Diagnosis, risk, 3 phenotypes, multiple treatable traits. This is a lot for clinicians to juggle. How do we manage this complexity over time? Which brings us to stage 5, follow-up.
It is complex, no doubt, but the follow-up stage is designed to manage that. Treatment isn't static. It needs regular reassessment and adjustment at, ideally, every clinic visit.
So what are we reassessing?
We're reevaluating everything. Yeah. Their current risk level? Are they still fitting the same phenotype? Have any new treatable traits emerged? And critically, are they controlled?
How do we measure control? Is it just asking how they feel?
It's more objective than that. The guidelines recommend using specific tools to assess clinical control. They mention the quantitative radar scale as an example. These scales look at multiple factors, like stability. They had an exacerbation in the last 3 months. Mm. What's their current level of dyspnea? How often are they using their rescue inhalers? And even their level of physical activity. It gives a more rounded picture of control.
And if they're deemed uncontrolled based on these measures,
then treatment intensification is needed. You step up therapy based on their current risk, phenotype, and any identified treatable traits you haven't yet addressed.
What about the flip side? Can we ever step down therapy? Particularly, can we take away the ICS if someone is doing well? De-escalation.
Yes, de-escalation, specifically ICS withdrawal, is addressed, PICO-12. Mm. It can be considered, but only under specific conditions.
Which are?
The patient needs to be clinically stable and well-controlled. They must have had infrequent exacerbations. The guideline defines this as zero or maybe one moderate exacerbation in the past year. And crucially, their blood eosinophil count must be below 300 Celsim.
Ah, the 300 threshold again.
Exactly. It's key for both starting and potentially stopping ICS. If the eosinophils are low, 300, and they're stable with few exacerbations, you might consider withdrawing ICS and continuing on the LAMA.
But what if their eosinophils are high, over 300?
Then ICS withdrawal is strongly recommended against, even if they seem stable. Taking away ICS and eosinophilic exacerbator patients carries a high risk of triggering more exacerbations. The underlying T2 inflammation likely needs ongoing suppression.
Okay, so wrapping this up, the big picture here is a massive shift, isn't it? We've gone from fairly simple staging to needing to understand these three distinct high-risk phenotypes, actively look for specific treatable traits, and use biomarkers like that 300 eosinophil count to really guide our drug choices, whether it's LABA/LAMA, adding ICS, or even considering biologics.
That's the core message, absolutely. The main takeaway for clinical practice is this drive towards personalized selection of therapy. We need to look deeper than just the surface symptoms, use objective markers, identify those clinical traits like chronic bronchitis or frequent infections, and choose treatments that target the specific underlying issues for that individual patient.
It feels like we're finally acknowledging just how varied COPD is, treating the whole patient, not just the FEV1 number. So here's a final thought to leave you with. The guidelines mention the value of CT scans and DLCO, the diffusing capacity test, for prognosis looking at lung structure and gas exchange. Given that, what other kinds of biomarkers, maybe things still in development, might become the next essential treatable trait we need to measure to personalize COPD care even further down the road? Something to think about.